are listening to the new voice of Conservative Talk Radio, unafraid and aggressive. He will take on anyone, including Republicans. This is Aaron McCready. Give Aaron a call at 646-200-3400. That's 646-200-3400. Also, follow him on Twitter at Aaron McCready and visit him on the web at aaronmccready.com.
Well, welcome to the program, everyone. I am Aaron McCready. It's great to be with you. I want you to give us a call at 646-200-3400. But before we begin, I would like to thank all of you out there because we are consistently a featured show and a staff pick on blogtalkradio.com. But, you know, while we're heard on other places, Blog Talk Radio is our home base. And being a staff pick, for those of you that don't know, is a huge, huge deal because Blog Talk Radio has thousands of shows each day and with millions of listeners each day. And to be a staff pick, they only pick 10 shows per day to be a staff pick. And we are consistently one of those shows. So tonight, starting at midnight until tomorrow at midnight, you can find this episode on Blog Talk Radio's homepage at blogtalkradio.com. So that is very exciting. And you can also follow me on Twitter. I almost have 13,000 followers. So let's see if we can push that over. It's not a whole lot, but let's see if we can push over to 13,000. But with all that said, I've got a great show tonight. Here in just a minute, I've got Karna Bodman, a fantastic guest. I'll introduce her. And then later on, I've got Dr. Anthony Napoleon. But let's jump right into it. And with no delay, Dr. Anthony will be on in a little bit. But right now, Karna Bodman, she was senior director and spokesperson for the National Security Council, and she had meetings almost daily with President Reagan. And she's also flown on Air Force One. She attended arms control talks with the Soviet Union and also traveled with a team that met with leaders in Great Britain, France, and Italy, as well as Pope John Paul II. And then after 6 years in the White House, she left the White House as the highest-ranking woman on the White House staff, and now she's a best-selling author. And her latest book, Castle Bravo, is an international thriller. Karna, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Aaron. It's great to be with you this evening, and good to hear about your show, all this staff pick. Hey, that's terrific.
Well, thank you so much. And you know what? Out of all your accolades and everything else that has went on with you, there's one thing that I am just green with envy about, and that is that you have flown on Air Force One.
Oh, well, of course, it was a joy. And now, if anybody wants to see it, it's the one that we had in the Reagan days. Of course, they have a new plane now. They get a new one every once in a while. But that one is on display at the Reagan Library out in California.
You know, I have been to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and they've got one that he flew on also. And that was the one that flew Kennedy's body back.
And
he got assassinated. So, you know, I was on there, and I was the only one on there, and I could look down the halls and the plane and just could imagine what went on.
I've also been on Air Force Two. But the reason I was on Air Force Two, I didn't normally fly with the vice president, but some of the guys who, the Secret Service types, had me come on board, and I interviewed the pilot and whatnot because I wrote my second book, Gambit, involving a vice presidential, you know, character in the story.
Oh, wow.
And so when we used to have a home on Jackson Hole, and, of course, Dick Cheney was out there. He was our neighbor. And Air Force Two was always parked right there, Jackson Hole Airport. So I'd go out there, you know, and the Secret Service guys, they'd come on board, and I interviewed the guys and was able to write a scene that was, you want to have it accurate, of course.
Oh, sure.
Everything in the book, you want it to be really, here are the seats, the colors, here's the little control areas, this is how they communicate. And so it's always exciting to be able to describe to people these little bits of important parts of our government.
Well, next time you're on Air Force One or Air Force Two, you know, don't hesitate to call your good buddy Aaron here, and
exactly.
I'd be glad to join you. But anyways, on to more serious things here. I want to get your take. What happened in this last election? Because I was totally floored. Based upon Barack Obama's past history, the past 4 years, I honestly thought, and I wasn't mad that he won re-election. I was more disappointed with the American people that we brought a president that was such a failure in the past 4 years that Barack Obama was. What happened?
Well, Aaron, I can echo that. In fact, not to make too light of this, when people have asked me about it, for the last several days, I've said, look, folks, I am so depressed I should be on Cymbalta. everyone now is, look, first of all, I'd like to make a couple of points on this. I joined you. I thought for a long, long time that Romney was going to win the election because I felt, I'm always the optimist, I felt in my heart that the American people were going to vote to better their lives because of for an improved economy, more jobs, energy independence, all of the things that Romney and our other candidates were voting for. But the fact of the matter is now with all the postmortems, he shouldn't have talked about, abortion. He should have talked more about immigration. He should have talked, we got the shoulda, couldas going on all over the place. But when you now look at some of the numbers, it turns out that Romney got something over a million, what was it, a million, 4 million, seven, I think,
right,
votes less than McCain got. But Obama received over 7 million less votes than he got the first time around. Granted, mm-hmm, he got a whole lot of votes. So I've also heard that close to 3 million Republicans didn't vote. Didn't bother to vote.
Right.
So if you look at those numbers, the deal is the other side had a terrific ground game. You got to give them that. They were in there with the local offices and the people in the streets and the unions and everybody else getting their vote out and pounding our candidates all through from the primaries on when we had all those ridiculous debates. Somebody has to figure that out. We shouldn't have, 12, however many there were, debates where we beat each other up. It's ridiculous. And they had ads running immediately tearing down Mitt, especially in Ohio. And he never really recovered. But my main point is about the numbers. We have to get our vote out. And if even half of the Republicans that didn't vote had voted, we probably would have won.
Oh, sure. People are saying, what should the Republicans do? Do the Republicans need to reform? Do they need to change? I don't think the Republicans need to do a single thing as far as changing, because it was the ground game and get out the vote, and it was pretty close in the popular vote. And you're right. If we would have got just half the Republicans that didn't vote, we would have won.
Well, right. Now, looking ahead, of course, certainly we'll look at changing demographics, and I do think that Senator Lindsey Graham has made some interesting points in the last couple of days about immigration reform. I mean, Republicans have tried immigration reform. Reagan had the Simpson-Mazzoli bill, which is supposed to fix things. Of course, didn't really fix things. They tried. Bush, of course, had an immigration bill. It didn't get through, and unfortunately there were some on our side, more to the far right, who fought it for various reasons. But I think Graham does have some points that we could look at, very realistic ones. We do have to deal with the immigration issue, and I think we can do it in a very fair way, which includes, obviously, securing the border. That's the first thing
right.
Anybody ever talks about, figuring out a way to deal with those who are here illegally, and he's talking about having everyone register, who they are, paying a fine, learning English, getting to the back of the line. Now, I don't know whether you heard the other day, Rush Limbaugh had it was a rather amusing segment talking about immigration. He said, well, why don't we just do this? Let's propose that first thing tomorrow morning, every single illegal immigrant in the country will come in, sign up, and be granted immediate legal residency, but they can't vote for 25 years.
Yeah.
Now, how do you think that would pass?
what I've thought that we should do is build, seal the borders, and then because there's just no way, in my opinion, and you, we may disagree on this, I don't know, but there's no way that we can send millions of the Hispanic population that may be here illegally home. I think that would just cripple the economy also.
No, we're not going to do that. And this is something else that we should have talked about in a more reasonable, compassionate way during the election.
Right.
No question. But, I totally agree with you.
But I think, you know, seal the borders, and then the people that's in here, go ahead and let them be here legally. Grant them, you know, people would call it, you know, amnesty.
Well, you can call it legal residency, but after they do, they pay a fine because they had broken the law. You have to make sure they don't have a police record, okay? You know, check all that out. But learn English. You know, there's got to be a test for, there's a test for citizenship if you're here legally. I mean, there is. And then get at the back of the line. You don't get full citizenship until all others, and it takes a long time, you know, who have green cards and all the rest of it, are waiting in line to take the test and become citizens. So there is a logical way to do this. I really believe that there is.
Well, what are we going to need to do in 2016, you know, to win? Because, are we just going to need to really pander to the Hispanic population? I mean,
I don't think that's it. I think once you have a realistic immigration policy, which I think we will figure out somehow, then we do have to focus on all the other issues that they are concerned with, and we were concerned with before, and that is jobs, the economy, and so forth. But really, nail that, get that message out there in a much better way, and I think we can do that. We have, you know, looking ahead, you mentioned 2016.
Mm-hmm.
What I believe all of us should be focusing on right now is not 2016, 2014.
Right.
What we have to do, and I'm talking tomorrow,
right,
is to start looking at every single Senate race that's going to be open, or, you know, who's running and where the few open seats might be, and then get the senatorial committee up and running, get some fundraising going, and identify some really reasonable, terrific candidates and back them to the hilt all over the country, because we have a chance. Aaron, we have a chance in 2014. If we can pick up 3 or 4 seats, you know, we could control the Senate, and
right,
there you are. We have the House and the Senate, and my goodness, we blunt any of Obama's last 2 years, and we protect the Supreme Court.
Well, and historically,
this is vital.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, historically, in the sixth year of a presidency, when they have 2 terms, it typically went to the opposition party.
That's right. And look what we did in 2010.
Right.
We picked up the House in 2010. I mean, we can do this, and I think that by 2014 there will be so many other things going on. You've got Obamacare kicking in with, we even see it now a few days after the election. All of the companies that are trying desperately to figure out how to cut their hardworking employees down to part-time status because they
right,
can't afford all of these looming health care costs. They either have to pay their health care or they have to pay a $2,000 fine. Now, if you're a small business, you got 50 or 60 people working for you, how are you going to do that? How are you going to afford it?
Right.
You can't. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen to unemployment at this point. Now, granted, we're a strong country, and we're going to sort of eke out, you know, some growth here and there as we've been doing. But, oh, my goodness, when I think about some of the comparisons to the Reagan days,
mm-hmm,
when a lot of your listeners are probably pretty young folks, and they perhaps don't remember. They think, oh yeah, he was a jolly guy. He had a good smile and a joke, and everybody seemed to like him. But what they may not realize or remember is that when we came into office, we had pretty tough times. We had 12.5% inflation, 21.5% interest rates, double-digit unemployment, and we were looking at a huge foe across the water with the Soviet Union, which had been mucking around in the Third World. They had been taking over in all kinds of areas of Ethiopia and Yemen and Nicaragua and rolling their tanks into Afghanistan. I mean, they were all over the place with their communistic and socialistic plans.
Mm-hmm.
And what did we do? You know, well, let's see. Oh, yes. Carter canceled the Russian Olympics, as I recall. That's a pretty tough call. But Reagan looked at all of these issues. And look at his prescriptions. Exactly the opposite of every single thing that's gone on in the last 4 years. Mm-hmm. Reagan called for a 25% cut in marginal tax rates across the board for everybody, job creators and less wealthy people all across the board, and also a major cut in regulations. When he came into power, there were something like 87,000 pages in the Federal Register. That's a publication that keeps track of all that nonsense. All the regulations that are listed, they're in there. When he left, there were 40,000 pages, cut up more than in half.
Wow.
Now, that had an enormous impact on businesses. You want to start up a little business, you don't have to deal with all the bureaucracy and the nonsense and the paperwork and, you know, everything else. But this administration. Well, and what was the result of all that? Well, you remember we started to have growth
right. When
it all kicked in. You know, 4%, and then some quarters we even had 7% growth in GDP, and we created something like 18 million new jobs. What do you got now? 1.3,
right.
1.9. I mean, it's just pathetic.
Right.
And we're the same people. It's just the government has got this weight down on our shoulders, and it makes it very, very hard to get up in the morning and compete.
I just don't understand how people can vote for higher taxes, especially in times like this, because the common sense would tell you otherwise.
You just take a poll and say, don't you think we should tax those big guys over there on Wall Street? Well, sure. They don't. The thing that's really maddening is, how can you love employees and hate employers?
Right.
Right.
And you know, people are down the rich, but when's the last time somebody's been hired by a poor person?
Well, I know. It's really hard. And the thing is, we do have to work so hard to get that message across. But there were an awful lot of people that, you know, I do think there are a lot of people who are kind of afraid of change and say, well, it's getting a little bit better, you know, maybe we'll just sort of hang in there and hope for the best.
Right.
There are some people that think that. And there are others who benefit greatly from expanded government. It's really a shame. In fact, we've just been getting some new numbers recently on food stamps. We know they've increased tremendously, and now way more people are on food stamps than ever before in history.
That's a tough number to cut, too.
It's very, very sad. So, but looking ahead, I always try to be constructive or optimistic if I can. Looking ahead, as we said, okay, 2014. So we're going to do that. But now, some of the things that Obama will control that even poor John Boehner can't really do anything about, we got foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, you know, the president's in charge of foreign policy, right?
Right.
I mean, Iran may get a nuclear weapon.
Right.
And now what are we going to do?
Well, you know, I think that this Petraeus deal going on was a blessing in disguise for the Obama administration, because that took Benghazi off the air. Now everybody's
focusing
on Petraeus.
Well, it did, but it's bringing it back, because everybody's wondering, well, gee, did he not want to testify? Who's going to testify? And now they're looking into this. Everybody knew last summer. I mean, some people knew.
Right.
And the CIA. I don't mean to make light of this, because obviously General Petraeus was a very hardworking soldier, a good patriot. He made a terrible mistake, and he's paying for that. And he knows it, and he's, I'm sure, very apologetic to his family and his friends. The only sort of, I can't even say light note, but there's this guy who comments on Imus in the morning, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when it first broke, he said, wait a minute. He was head of the CIA, right? I mean, wouldn't you think he'd know how to keep a secret?
Right. Well, you know, the just looking at it, I think there's got to be something more to this, because, I mean, my goodness, look at Bill Clinton. I mean, he knew.
He was impeached for it, and
yeah.
But what they're looking at is the national security implications, and now that these quotes are coming out from the speech that the girlfriend gave, and how did she know this, and what are these things about we supposedly were holding prisoners there at the annex in Benghazi, and it's getting very murky. And the other thing is, they didn't notify the chairman of the committees.
Right.
This is unconscionable. You have to notify. You can't have Dianne Feinstein learning something in the news.
Right.
You can't do that. So either they were covering up, or they were totally inept. And that goes for the whole Benghazi situation as well. Take your pick. It's one or the other.
Well, it's absolutely a cover-up, in my opinion. I mean, and even Petraeus. He was in on it too, as far as saying, you know, he knew one thing but saying another.
Well, I think it's all going to come out. Peter King will hold hearings, and we will find out about this sort of thing. But on the whole foreign policy front, I think we have an awful lot to be worried about, and that we have to keep our eye on. We have this looming sequestration situation. I know there's all the talk about the fiscal cliff and the taxes and so forth, but and they'll probably just delay some of those sequestration cuts for another, I don't know, 60 days, 90 days, let the new Congress handle it. But the problem is, one of the things that I've been looking at, having been so concerned about national security issues, is the looming cuts for the Pentagon.
Right.
Because Obama already has put through $500 billion in cuts, and you're looking at another $500 billion in cuts. If this thing goes forward, if they don't negotiate something, and they're going to say, "Well, we got to have a deal, and we got to cut expenses every place we can," and everybody wants to cut government, but I'll tell you, even Panetta says they can't go through with these kinds of cuts. You can cut some things, of course, at the Pentagon, but there are an awful lot of things you really can't and shouldn't. And it also means a heck of a lot of jobs that would be lost.
Oh, sure.
In fact, I've got hold of a study that George Mason University did about these cuts and what it would mean for different states. I'm down here in Florida right now, and they're saying Florida would lose 42,000 jobs and about $2.3 billion in wages and, you know, that sort of thing. You can pick another state. Let's see. Here's another one. Colorado, 18,000 jobs. Arizona, 35,000 jobs.
Wow.
I mean, even New Hampshire, Nevada, New Mexico, Michigan, a combined 13,000 jobs. You know, they can't. I'm just saying it's all over the place. Even Pennsylvania, 39,000 jobs. Ohio, 21,000 jobs. And Virginia, 136,000 jobs.
Wow.
For these, if these defense cuts were to go through, and nobody really talked about that before the election.
Well, how with all these defense cuts, and we've got Iran, you know, and I think in the next 4 years, Obama's going to deal with a nuclear Iran.
Well, that's right.
How
possibly.
Is that? I mean,
possibly.
Yeah. How's that going to? I mean, that's just going to kill us. And even in your book, Castle Bravo. Refers to even, you know, they don't need a nuclear weapon to hit a United States city. They just have to blow one up over a population.
Well, that's right. In fact, let me explain if I can take a moment to do that.
Sure.
The premise of my new thriller, this is my fourth book. It just came out, Castle Bravo. The story was inspired by a conversation I had with the major general who is in charge of all of our missile defense forces worldwide. And this is a really bright guy. His people helped me with a lot of research. And we were in a conversation. He said, "Colonel, let me explain to you why we really need an expanded missile defense system." And, of course, missile defense is something that I saw at its birth, you know, with President Reagan when he was so excited about the idea of missile defense. And at the time,
Star Wars program,
though,
right?
Was there Star Wars, right? There were so many arguments in Washington, I'll tell you. I'll take a moment and tell you about that because it's kind of amusing to look back. The guys over at the State Department basically were saying, "Oh, what is Star Wars, missile defense? What does Reagan think he's Superman, a bullet hitting a bullet? Yeah, it's not going to work. Yeah, this is crazy, but that's okay. We'll use it as a bargaining chip. We'll bargain it away to the Soviets for some in arms control talks for some of their SS-18s and SS-20 missiles, and that'll be good for us, you know." Well, then the guys over at the Pentagon took a look at it, and they said, "Oh, wow, this is a heck of a challenge, but the president has tasked us to try to see if we can figure it out, so we'll put out a lot of contracts with defense contractors. It's going to cost a lot of money, but on the other hand, that'll force the Soviets to spend a lot of money, and which they don't have, because they always try to keep up with us, and that'll help bankrupt their economy, and that'll be good for us." Some of that happened. But then Reagan took what I've always called, what he called, a third view, the moral approach, because all we had in place at the time, and in fact we kind of still do, is a policy called mutual assured destruction, or the MAD doctrine, mm-hmm. which said in effect that if the Soviets, or anybody else, or today, lobbed a missile our way, even by mistake, it would kill millions of innocent people. And all we could do, if it had a return address, would be lob one back at them and kill millions of their innocent people.
Right.
Well, Reagan said, wait, no, that's not on. I've studied all this. This is not the way I want to conduct our foreign policy. He said, wouldn't it be better to task our best scientific minds, our best technology people, and just see if there isn't some way to stop a missile before anybody dies? And his great line was, wouldn't it be better to save lives than avenge lives? And that was his dream. And, you know, Aaron, I wish, I'd give anything if Reagan were alive today mm-hmm. to see that his dream is working.
Okay.
We've had 52 successful tests against ballistic missile targets. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, so here I was in this conversation with this major general about missile defense. And he said, let me tell you why now, today, we really need more missile defense. Because we have interceptors on the West Coast, nothing on the East Coast, nothing looking inward. Okay. He said, just imagine it's a couple years down the road, and there's some militant group, country doesn't like us, some group or another, and they somehow get hold of a small nuclear device. Now, we know they're all trying, right? I mean, you know, they're all trying, and proliferation is a huge issue, and Pakistan has a bunch already. All right. Now, let's say they also get hold of some sort of a delivery vehicle, you know, a missile you could strap it onto to shoot it off. Okay, it could be as simple as a Scud missile.
Right.
And by the way, I've discovered you can buy a Scud missile from a black market arms dealer for about $100,000.
Oh, nice.
Somebody tried to sell one on eBay and they caught him.
But, oh, wow.
So let's say this group of bad guys is off one of our coasts, and they have these components, and they're in some disguised fishing vessel. You know, you'd never find them out there, you know. And what they're going to do is they're not going to aim it at New York City or San Francisco, which would be unbelievable, but let's say they're going to shoot it straight up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And if they detonate it many, many miles up in the air, it's not going to kill people on the ground. That isn't what happens. Interestingly enough, it doesn't. What it does, though, is picture a bunch of shock waves emanating from that explosion, like microwaves, you know, shocking out. And it's called an electromagnetic pulse, or EMP. Now, what that does is it fries all the electronics on the ground. We would have no electricity grid, no communications, no ATMs, no cell phones. You'd have no communication. You'd have no aviation, transportation, refrigeration, sanitation, health records, nothing. He said, Karna, it would set us back to the year 1910.
Well, just look
and
at New Jersey,
New York.
And they
don't come back. Listen, they don't come back like after a blackout
mm-hmm.
or after a power failure. Like a, no, they don't. They're fried. They got to be replaced.
Oh,
and so even
years.
The turbines that run, say, our electricity grid or something, we don't have extras in the closet, you know.
I mean,
they have to be manufactured, and we don't even make them anymore. They make them in Japan or someplace. So his point is it could take years, and other countries are very well aware of EMP weapons. In fact, our scientists and Soviet scientists learned about the effects of this EMP kind of explosion way, way back in the 50s and 60s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, when we did atmospheric testing. We did way out in the Pacific, out in the Marshall Islands, and Eniwetok, Bikini Atoll, places like that.
Right.
And the Soviets did atmospheric testing over land. I mean, at least we moved the natives off the islands, you know. But they even put some people closer to check what, you know, what the radiation effects would be. I mean, it was absolutely tragic. But in any event, so the general was telling me all this, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I've got to write a story about this.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a ton of research, and in fact, I even found diaries of the people who had been moved off the islands for these
wow.
tests. and kind of wove it into a story, and then but it's contemporary story.
Mm-hmm.
And my heroine is the White House director of the Office of Homeland Security in the White House, and she has the love of her life, works for an energy company, who gets sent overseas and gets caught up in just such an occurrence that happens by mistake during a test. Now, does he get out? Well, hey, don't be too sure. You know, what happens?
Yeah.
You've got to read the story.
Right.
But I'm trying to call attention to these kinds of things because other countries really are developing these kinds of weapons. And, in fact, you can develop what they call e-weapons, these electronic weapons, using other components besides nuclear. In fact, just a couple weeks ago, I have it right here. It was October 24th. Boeing announced that they have this new fancy, they did a fancy test, and it's called CHAMP. You know, you have to have these names, you know, for things.
Sure.
It stands for Counterintelligence High-Powered Microwave Advanced Missile Project, okay? So what they did was they set up this test, and they had a building filled with computers and electronics and all kinds of stuff. And they worked on it with the Air Force Research Lab. And what they did was they directed this high-powered microwave e-weapon at the building with this burst of high power. And they went in there, and when they did, everything was fried inside, even the TV cameras that were recording the test.
Oh.
Now, they all cheered, and they said, hey, it works. Great. Wait until somebody aims one of those numbers at us.
Right.
Now, we did, as a matter of fact, we did use an e-weapon, much smaller, but the same idea, at the beginning of the Iraq War,
mm-hmm.
because we knocked out Saddam's military communications.
Wow.
So we know how to do it. But others know how to do it, too. And you know what? Our government's doing nothing.
Well, unfortunately,
to protect us.
I think it's going to be one of those things, God forbid that it happens, and then it wakes us up later.
Well, we don't dare. I mean, for example, the Department of Homeland Security, they have not adopted any kind of planning scenario for an EMP event, even though they're very well aware of it. They have a director of something called the Homeland Infrastructure Threat and Risk Analysis Center. You know, they got all these bureaus, right?
Right.
And they can't even come up with an estimate of what it would cost to harden our systems.
Wow.
I mean, some of our military communications are hardened, of course. Air Force One is hardened and so forth. But what about the electricity grid? What about
right.
cell towers? What about you and me?
Oh, sure. It's a scary, scary thing.
So, in any event, there's the story of Castle Bravo.
Well, make sure everybody gets it out there, because it is actually in my Kindle right now, and I'm in the process of reading it. And
well, there you go. I'm having a good time with the story, but you see, I'm trying to call attention to these threats to national security, because George Bernard Shaw had a great line. He said, the best way to get your point across is to entertain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're doing with your show, right?
Right, right.
You're getting your point across. And so I am, too. Now, I don't know whether you or your listeners have had a chance to watch that NBC show, Revolution. It's on Monday nights at 10. I mean, I watched a couple of episodes. It's a little bit over the top. But the premise is right out of my story, because it's all about how would we survive after all electronics are gone, fried
right.
in some way. Now, they don't explain exactly how, but they've got tribes marauding the countryside and militias and you know, all that sort of thing. But this is a very real thing, something that we really should focus on. And anyway, I hope someday they do. But I guess the underlying point is that when Congress goes through these expected cuts, and Obama has more, quote, flexibility on
right.
missile defense, I just hope to heck they do not cut the missile defense budget. It's tiny. It's about, the total budget is $9 billion out of a half a trillion. And knowing I was going to talk to you, I ran some numbers, and it's about 0.014% of the Pentagon budget.
Wow.
Let's not cut it.
Sure.
Let's expand it.
Well, we can't afford to cut it. So, Karna, with that being said, I have got to run to a news break. We'll have to save this for another time, but you know, thank you so much for coming on.
I absolutely enjoyed it.
Castle
Bravo. It's a lot of fun.
And I hope everybody gets it and reads it. And hopefully you'll come on again soon.
I would love to. We'll be in touch. And good luck to you, Aaron. Good luck with your show.
Well, thank you so much once again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is Karnam Bodman. She was in the Reagan administration. We'll be right back right after this news break.
Fox News Radio, I'm Jean Metzler. Concerns classified information was compromised. Former CIA Director David Petraeus and his mistress, the focus of some tough questions.
The questions stem from an October 26 speech by Paula Broadwell, where she claimed the Benghazi attacks were triggered by the CIA holding Libyan militia members. The CIA denies that, but it's raised questions about whether Broadwell got that information from a relationship with David Petraeus. Meanwhile, the FBI is taking heat for not informing Congress when it unearthed the affair.
Not informing the chairman and the ranking member of the Intelligence Committee that there was this activity surrounding the director of the CIA is absolutely outrageous.
Former House Intel Chair Pete Hoekstra says this may damage the FBI's credibility. In Washington, Mike Makowicz, Fox News Radio.
The investigation continues in Indianapolis into Saturday night's explosion and fire that killed two people, destroying more than two dozen homes.
We did not receive a call from this residence that they thought they had a faulty furnace.
Sarah Holsapple, spokeswoman for Citizens Energy. FDA investigators finding filthy conditions at that Massachusetts pharmacy linked to the deadly outbreak of fungal meningitis. Insects and a bird were flying around. Some unidentified brown material coated metal surfaces, contaminated steroid shots blamed for the outbreak. A NASCAR star gets slammed after a televised brawl.
Oh, conflict. The crews are at it.
Four-time champ Jeff Gordon fined $100,000, docked 25 points for intentionally wrecking fellow driver Clint Boyer during a race in Phoenix on ESPN yesterday. Gordon also placed on probation through the end of this year. His actions triggered a fight in the garage area. You're listening to Fox News Radio, Fair and Balanced.
When you're on the go and need to know, it's Fox News Radio, live, anytime, anyplace. And it's as easy as foxnewsradio.com. Listen to the most recent newscast or your favorite Fox Talk personalities. Just go to foxnewsradio.com or download the Fox News Channel app for news, video, weather, and Fox News Talk from one app on iPhone, iPad, Android, Windows Phone, and more. Go to foxnews.com/mobile. Stay connected to Fox News and Fox News Radio.
It's been called shell shock, war neurosis, and battle fatigue. Today, we call it post-traumatic stress disorder, and it affects one out of every five warriors returning from battle in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Wounded Warrior Project offers comfort and support for warriors with PTSD and all other scars of war, whether those scars are visible or hidden. Find out how to help, because for warriors, the greatest casualty is being forgotten. Please visit WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Five found dead in a home in Toledo, Ohio. Two adults, three children. Police say carbon monoxide poisoning may be to blame. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo asking the federal government for $30 billion to help with Superstorm Sandy recovery efforts, adding,
climate change is real. It's here. It's going to happen again. What do we do about it? And how do we harden our systems? How do we make sure this doesn't happen with the fuel system again? How do we make sure it doesn't happen with the cell phone system?
President Obama heads back to the area this Thursday. One place he'll visit, New York, Staten Island. New Jersey, meantime, ending its post-Sandy odd-even gas rationing system tomorrow morning. An indication power and demand are at more manageable levels. Women drivers now pulling ahead of their male counterparts.
For years, there's been a gender gap on the roads, and now it's reversed. More women have a driver's license than men in a new University of Michigan study, which also says that could lower other numbers, including miles driven and fatality rates, and lead to safer, smaller, more fuel-efficient cars. The study looked at trends between 1995 and 2010 and found a decline in both sexes in the share of teens and young adults getting licenses. But for young men, the decline was greater. Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Going on display in Georgia, jewels recovered from the Titanic. The bag pulled out of the water during a 1987 recovery mission.
Going down 2.5 miles to the ocean, recovering a bag, bringing it back up, and opening it and finding jewelry fabulous jewels, sparkling in the light after almost 100 of years of being in the darkness. And that's an excitement that was only shared by the people on the ship.
Alexandra Klinkelhofer, vice president of Titanic Collections. The exhibit opens Friday in Atlanta. 2 months later, it moves to Orlando and then Las Vegas. I'm Jane Metzler, Fox News Radio.
To the new voice of conservative talk radio, unafraid and aggressive, he will take on anyone, including Republicans. This is Aaron McCready.
Give Aaron a call at 646-200-3400. That's 646-200-3400. Also, follow him on Twitter at Aaron McCready and visit him on the web at aaronmccready.com.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. I am Aaron McCready. Give us a call, 646-200-3400. That will get you straight on to the show. And I'd like to thank my previous guest, Karna Bodman, former spokesperson and senior director of the of an organization inside the White House called the National Security Council. You may have heard of it. But I'd like to welcome my next guest on the show, Dr. Anthony Napoleon. He's a nationally recognized trial analyst and forensic psychologist, and he is internationally recognized as an expert in forensic profiling, and his work's been on Court TV, NPR, and other major television outlets. And his clients have included governmental entities and also the private sector, and he's president of Napoleon Legal Consulting. He has a book called The Progressive Virus, Why You Can't Permit It to Go Forward. Dr. Anthony Napoleon, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you, Aaron.
Well, thank you so much. Can you explain that title of the book for us?
Well, the progressive virus, Why You Can't Permit It to Go Forward, originated from my awareness, my studies, which revealed that revolutionaries used the virus as their model, and how the virus is able to circumvent we humans' immune system. And the revolutionaries recognized that the best way to create a revolution is to undermine an existent country from within. Mm-hmm. To do that, you have to change perceptions, thoughts, how reality is viewed. And they understood that to do this, they would have to be very clever, that in the United States, where revolutionaries have always had their sights targeted because we're so rich, and because revolutionaries believed that the American public could be easily brainwashed, they targeted the American public using the model of the virus. It happens to be the progressive virus. Mm-hmm. It could have been any other political paradigm or cognitive structure, but this one that has influenced and infected the United States just so happens to have been created by Marxist revolutionaries, designed by Marxist revolutionaries, and instituted with great effectiveness, I might say.
Right.
That's the origin of the name.
Well, you know, one thing that I think, and I think especially this administration, and especially with the numbers coming out today of, you know, more people on food stamps, you know, and this actually reminds me of a paper that my sister-in-law did here recently for one of her college courses. And she actually asked me, and other people too, why we thought that there was poor in the United States. And actually, before we leave the program today, for the listeners out there, I'm going to actually read my response to my sister-in-law. And by the way, she got an A-plus on her paper, so great job, Erica. But you know, my response to her was, why we have so many poor people in the United States, it boils down to individual responsibility. And also in my response to her on why I think there were poor people is that currently the politicians want to put more people on either food stamps, government handouts, so they're more reliant on government, so they will not, you know, so they'll reelect those same people to office. They'll gain more power, and, you know, in turn, they've got all this power. You know, it's no holds barred of what they could do to this country. I mean, am I wrong in thinking that?
No. What you're describing, Aaron, are the symptoms of something more fundamental and much more profound and devious. Let me, if I may, take your notion about poor people and the displacement of responsibility. The virus is a psychological belief system, and permit me to say a word about how powerful that can be, because I think a lot of rational listeners fail to appreciate the power of the mind and how changing perception can make macro changes in the socio-economic and political system. In fact, last Tuesday, that's exactly what you saw. When I was in clinical training, we took a course on hypnosis, and I had come from Indiana University, which was at the time we had the largest medical school, and we thought of ourselves as empiricists. In other words, we were very rational. We thought like surgeons.
Right.
And frankly, Aaron, I thought that hypnosis was rather out there and crazy. But I saw a professor do something that enlightened me. He hypnotized a young woman, a graduate student, and he took a number two pencil at room temperature, and he convinced her that this was a hot poker. And he took the number two pencil, the eraser, and he gently touched the back of her hand, upon which she developed a second degree burn. This is because she believed that the number two pencil eraser was a hot poker.
Well,
you yourself know, for instance, if you've been to Disneyland or Orlando or Disneyland Anaheim, California, mm-hmm. that they have a number of simulators, and you can sit in a seat and you can imagine yourself flying through the air, and you become some of the people on there. If you work there, you'll hear the workers say that they have barf bags.
Right.
Some people will throw up despite the fact that they're sitting in a seat. This is because the brain has a difficult time distinguishing between reality and fake reality that is presented. You know, we all, for instance, have attended at one time or another a magician's show,
mm-hmm.
and we pay to be entertained. We know in reality that the lady isn't actually cut in half, but it looks exactly like she's cut in half. And in fact, studies of individuals who watch a magician's set of illusions oftentimes develop rapid heart rates, they begin to sweat, they suffer anxiety, but it's not real. So yeah. Imagine if people who are revolutionaries and they understand that war revolution is a nasty job. You have to kill lots of people. It's bloody. It's messy.
Right.
And so the key is what they decided to do is they would revolutionize. They would undo the country, and they would use all of these sophisticated techniques that generally only clinical psychologists and forensic specialists and psychiatrists are aware of. In
mm-hmm.
fact, we're sworn to keep them secret. These revolutionaries have used them systematically in a premeditated way to alter perception. And getting back to your reference to the poor,
well, If you can hang on to one second, I'm
to displace responsibility.
Well, I'm still hung up on the poker. The how could that cause a second degree burn being at room temperature? Because isn't a burn a physical reaction and not a mental?
No, because no. Let me explain if I may. The brain has a number of nerve endings and essentially uses a body to communicate with the environment. And nerve endings go to their efferent, and nerve endings come back to the brain afferent. And if you believe something, then there are all kinds of physiological changes. For example, when you've read a frightening book or watched a scary movie, your body secretes vasopressin and adrenaline, and you'll develop a rapid heart rate. You may begin to sweat. Your pupils dilate. There are all kinds of physical changes. By the way, it's more dramatic than simply a second-degree burn because, let me give you, everything's on a continuum. You know, if I embarrass you, you might blush.
Right.
And you think about that, you say, well, what is blushing? Well, that is a profound dilation of capillaries in your skin, and you can see it.
Right.
And it is profound. It's just a short throw to be able to arouse those nerve endings and create a second-degree burn. Physicians will tell you, for example, in fact, I had this conversation the other day when I was sharing with him my experience that I just shared with you and your audience, that he said, this is a physician who had worked in the Navy for years, that he would do vasectomies using hypnosis. Now, trust me, a vasectomy can be very painful, and most of us prefer to have a local anesthetic and something called Versed and fentanyl to quiet us down. It's sort of a twilight. But there are some patients you can hypnotize, and that's the reverse, where you shut off nerve endings going to the brain such that you can actually cut sensitive areas of the body. We've known this for years, and it's profound. So I think it's an eye-opener for the public, and I think it's also disconcerting. I think we rational folks don't really feel comfortable becoming aware that there are such things and that you can make people do things and you can, against their will, and you can make them perceive things that aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
But my point is, and when I became aware of this, this is what in part motivated me to write the book, there was this wholesale movement by revolutionaries to use these sophisticated techniques to make changes in the American public. And they've been at it since the 1960s, and they've wound up for a half century, and they've created a number of changes in the American public's mindset, how we process information, how we respond emotionally, our attention span. And by the way, this is not just psychological. Our brains have actually changed.
Mm-hmm.
We don't look the same on a PET scan, for example, the same way that our father's brains looked at the same stimuli. So we perceive the world totally differently, and we perceive it the way that the revolutionaries wanted us to perceive it, because we would then, as Americans, embrace their political dogma. And that is, in fact, what happened last Tuesday, just to cite a classic example.
Right. One question real quick. I do not understand this at all. The Democrats and what they've done to this country mainly Barack Obama in the past 4 years, they got a lot of the Hispanic vote, and there's concerns that the Republicans need to pander to the Hispanics now. But I do not understand, and maybe this is along the same lines that you're talking about, how the Hispanics can come to this country from say Mexico and vote against the very thing that they're coming to this country for. It makes absolutely no sense to me.
Yes, and it makes, yes, exactly. And this is what I'm hearing is the rational mind of Aaron McCready trying to fit the square peg into the round hole. It doesn't make sense to you in the same way that it doesn't make sense that I would have to be given a barf bag sitting on a ride at Disneyland where I darn well know that nothing's moving and I'm not falling. I'm sitting in a little seat. I know it's a ride. I paid to get in to go on this ride. There's this ride in Orlando, if you want to study and as you begin to think about these things,
mm-hmm.
and it is the ride where you fly over in a glider
right.
various parts of the United States. And if you watch those people, I pointed this out to my wife the last time we rode this ride, people raise their feet up as though they're going to hit the bridge.
Oh, yeah.
When they come over the San Francisco Bridge, they lift their legs up. Now, they know if you say, wait, stop. You're on a ride. You're in Anaheim, California. You're not really flying, but they lift their legs up, and they squeal, and they scream. and but it's not real. So, the human brain is completely irrational, and you can circumvent it. You can make it do things that otherwise wouldn't do it. So in other words, when you cite to undocumented workers in particular, and out here in California, we have 33% of all the welfare cases in the United States of America are here. So we're right. perfectly aware of this. Getting a group of people to behave illogically, I've tried to make the point, for example, using rational thought, that if you leave your native country to come to a different land because presumably it is better, and mm-hmm. then you set about to modify that country, in this case the United States, so that it comes to resemble your former country, where are you going to go when you're tired of what you've created?
Right. I just don't get it.
Rationality has absolutely nothing to do with it. By the way, let me add this. With reference to undocumented workers,
mm-hmm.
the revolutionaries knew that they had to dissolve the common matrix of a culture, and so they invoked something called multiculturalism.
Mm. Well, this is like the Trojan horse.
Borders. Exactly. They literally sat down, Aaron, wrote it out, planned it, hired some of my colleagues, hired some of the smartest people in the world who, for money or because they themselves were socialist revolutionaries, decided that they would embark upon what's called Fabian socialism, named after a Roman military leader who said exactly what you just said. It's a lot easier to sneak up on somebody or come in as a Trojan horse than having to go around and kill, as Joe Stalin or Nikolai Lenin or Mao or the Khmer Rouge or other socialist revolutions. It's actually professed. So they decided they would dissolve the borders and they would appeal to the greed of our enemies within the conservative movement who were interested in cheap labor. These are the enemies within the conservative movement. And the progressives had been so brainwashed by multiculturalism that, of course, all people are equal. There are no differences. There are no changes. No other country in the world, by the way, has multiculturalism, but we do. And so the combination of individuals who had been infected with multiculturalism, which is just one component of the progressive virus, with those enemies within our conservative side who want cheap labor, and you wake up one day and you have tens of millions. And then once you've got that, it's easy to motivate identity politics, which is the lowest form of political discourse. I'm going to vote for this guy or gal because they're more like me. They
right.
have the same skin color or they speak the same language. And is it rational? Absolutely not. Did it work? Absolutely did. You can buy a vote for a cell phone, for a baby mama welfare check, or because essentially you are promising, I'm going to allow your uncles and your aunts and your cousins to come here. And but that's how they did it.
Well, what's it going to take to destroy this virus? Because, I mean, as you know, there's some viruses out there that just take over and eventually kill the host. Well, I mean, is this going to kill us? Or,
that is.
Or do we
by
have
the way,
a
that
hope?
Is exact. You know, you bring up the wonderfully insightful comment, Aaron, if I don't mind saying so. All viruses ultimately destroy the host cell. Communists, socialists, progressives, Marxists are very good at creating revolution. They have no idea what to do with the country once they overcome it. Lenin overthrew the Tsar, killed the Tsar, killed millions of people, Joe Stalin also. And once they got the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc countries, their claim to fame was a space program and the Yugo. Ultimately, it dissolved. In Cuba, if you go to Cuba, again, they created a revolution. They're very good at creating revolution.
Right.
All of the cars are 1950s Buicks and Chevys and Oldsmobiles. It's mm-hmm. quite a sight to see. If you love classic American cars, Cuba is a great place to go because the streets are full of them. But the country is poor, it's miserable, and they don't know what to do. The Khmer Rouge took over parts of Southeast Asia in Cambodia, and they ended up, you know, ultimately they have to kill millions of people. Mao Zedong chased out all the rational Chinese to Formosa at the time, Chiang Kai-shek, left the country, and Mao, Chairman Mao, who, by the way, Elizabeth Warren, who just defeated Scott Brown, we call her Pocahontas, defeated him, and she, I have her on video saying that the one person she admires more than any other person is Chairman Mao. You want to talk about reason? You want to talk about logic? It's, you know, when you actually look at the data, and again, I think what's profound in my message is you have to go through the looking glass, guys. You can no longer think rationally. I love rational thought. Mm-hmm. I wish the world were rational. It would make sense. You know, I told someone the other day, I said, they studied the virus. They studied animals. If you've ever tried to hunt a bird or sneak up on a bird, you know that birds are pretty smart. They mm-hmm. seem to be well attuned. Their nerve endings are so good, you can't sneak up on them. But guess what? The cat mm-hmm. knows how to do it.
Yeah.
A cat can sneak up on a bird. And if you study this, you think, you stupid bird. But how does the cat do it? He creeps.
Mm-hmm.
He creeps inch by inch. You know, Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn and Jeff Jones in the 1960s decided to be anarchists, and they tried to bomb their way to a revolution. But they got smart. They said, you know what? Bernadine Dorn spent almost a year in federal penitentiary. Mm-hmm. Ayers was a nervous wreck. He was on medication because of the stress.
And he helped get his guy in office?
Yes, and he said, listen, we're going to infiltrate. Your audience probably doesn't know. They probably know the name Bill Ayers, but they don't know what he does.
And that's actually what Barack
Bill
Obama
Ayers,
started his campaign in his living room.
He did, but what is Bill Ayers most famous for? You will be shocked, and your audience will be shocked. He is a prolific writer for public school teachers. In other words, your listeners, if they have children who attend public school, the chances are 99.9% that your listeners' children's teachers were brainwashed by Bill Ayers. In 2001, Bill conducted an interview with Chicago Magazine, and in that interview he said, I urge children to kill your parents. In that same year, he and his wife, Bernadine Dorn, wrote a book for public school teachers, and they're forced, by the way, to read it and study it and pass tests, wherein they are forbade to do any discipline whatsoever, even a scowl, even a harsh word, even a change in inflection. Aaron, you shouldn't do that. You're not allowed to do that. And I write in my book, one has to wonder about a man who urged children to kill your parents and at the same time, in the same year, wrote a book on doing discipline in the public schools. And if you've been in a public school, you see that these individuals have created a generation where reading, writing, and arithmetic has been replaced with amorality, multiculturalism, I'm entitled to my own pronunciations and my own spellings. For instance, in the public schools in California, if you are a member of an African-American genealogy, you can spell earth, E-A-R-T-H, by U-R-F, and they are forbade. They cannot criticize you.
Oh, great old Ebonics.
That's right. The earth is round because we are an oppressor. And, you know, I cite that, you know, they've been absolutely brilliant. They're devious, but they're absolutely brilliant at what they did. And we were absolutely stupid. We gave them the keys to the schoolhouse. We allowed them to come into government and to take our taxpayer money and brainwash bureaucrats. Not that the bureaucrats needed much help to go crazy, but they helped them along, believe it or not, with your tax money, with
right.
my tax money. A guy by the name of Gregory May came into the FAA and the Department of Defense and Department of Transportation, and they paid him $41.4 million in 1984 to teach EST. What is EST? It is a progressive, agnostic, atheist, anti-traditional America way of thinking, started by Jack Rosenberg, who dumped his wife and four kids, moved to California, named himself Werner von Erhard, and started EST, one of the psychobabble, brainwashing, poisonous vaccines. And your tax money paid for it. The Department of Defense and Department of Transportation referred to May as the second coming of Christ.
Well,
that's how powerful they thought he was, and we paid for it.
Well, we just have a couple minutes left, but let me ask you this. You know, as you said before, virus eventually, you know, consume their hosts. Are we at a point right now that we can survive this, that it may have only infected like an arm or a leg and we can go ahead and amputate it and still survive? Or are we too far gone that we just have years to live and then we're finished?
You cannot ever give up, and none of us are smart enough to be that pessimistic. However, when I finished writing the book long before the election, I stated that traditional America, that America that our founders intended, that America that we all love, that which provided all of us the opportunity that we've enjoyed, is hanging on by a thread. They made their big push in 2008. They felt the time was ripe, and they made their big push to effectuate the finishing touches of the revolution. However, and they expect, by the way, a counter-revolution. My point of the book is, folks, you need to wake up. You need to be sophisticated. I'm going to share, because I want to protect the United States, I'm going to share all of their inside secrets. It's an exposé. Once you know how the trick is done, the trick no longer has the effect. It certainly isn't as powerful. And we're going to have to stop. See, we walk right into the buzzsaw. We say things and we do things and we pick faces for conservatism that nobody likes. Nobody. And they shove it where the moon don't shine, and we wake up the next morning and the same folks who are not sophisticated make the same mistakes, and they cheer even louder. Folks, you need to wake up. It's happening. It has happened. But we did it once, and we can do it again. But this time, we're going to have to be sophisticated. We're going to have to use fighting fire with fire, and that's the point of the book.
Well, Dr. Anthony Napoleon, thank you so much for coming on. The book is called The Progressive Virus, Why You Can't Permit It to Go Forward. And I guess a saying comes to mind from Ronald Reagan. He said, don't give up on your ideals. There are millions who want what you want, and that's what we need to keep doing, fighting forward, keep going, try to combat what we're up against, and hopefully the good will overcome what we're against.
The country is worth saving.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it, and you're welcome back anytime.
My pleasure. Thank you, Aaron.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Dr. Anthony Napoleon. You've seen him on shows like Court TV, and he's got a new book, The Progressive Virus, Why You Can't Permit It to Go Forward. I thank him for coming on the show, and also having Karna Bodman on earlier from the Reagan administration. But before we leave, as I promised, I wanted to read what I wrote to my sister-in-law when she asked me why I thought there were poor people in the United States. She got other people's viewpoints. And my wife, we were actually getting ready to go to dinner, and I said, I have got to send this to Erica. So I sat down and just started typing, and it ended up being one, two, three, almost five paragraphs. And it's just what I think and what I thought, and maybe you think the same thing. But this is why I think there's poor in the United States. This is what I wrote to her. Here's my opinion on why there are poor people in the U.S. When people are born, we are only guaranteed one thing, time. Everyone on Earth has 24 hours in a day, 365 days in a year. It's what we choose to do with this time that can make us wealthy or poor. At the turn of the last century, immigrants came over to the United States with just dollars or cents in their pocket. These people were not guaranteed a job, were not guaranteed welfare. The only thing they had was each other and their work ethic. These people worked hard each day to try to make a life for themselves and their family. Was it easy? No. Was it hard? Yes. These immigrants knew that if they wanted to live the American dream and succeed, they needed to work for it and work hard. They knew that you reap what you sow. While they did not have money, they did have time. It's what they made of this time that helped make them and this country. Today's poor in the United States have not taken advantage of the one thing that we all have, time. People must take responsibilities for their actions. For some, it may be lack of work, relationships, or circumstances. However, history has shown us that time and time again, people have overcome these odds. The U.S. government is also partly to blame. The government has created a culture of entitlement. Politicians' number one goal is to get reelected. These politicians focus on lower-income citizens. They make promises and give handouts, so it makes them more reliant on government and gives government greater power. Until we create more of a culture of hard work rather than handouts, this problem will only increase. The poor in the United States is classified by the government as 36 million people. These people live far better than the poor of other countries. The following are statistics from the Heritage Foundation. Of the so-called poor in the United States, here is what the poor have. 75% own a car. Of those, 30% own two cars. 97% have a color television. 78% have a DVD or VCR. 62% have cable. 73% have microwave ovens. The poor in this country live far better than the poor of other countries. In short, why are there poor in the United States? While there are some exceptions, it comes down to individual responsibility. We are all guaranteed the same amount of time in a day. It is what we do with this time that determines our destiny. That is what I wrote to my sister-in-law, and her hard work got her that A+. I had nothing to do with it, but I just wanted to share with you why I thought there was poor in the United States. It's been a great honor and privilege to come to you today. As always, you can reach me at blogtalkradio.com/Aaron McCready. You can follow me on Twitter. I need those 13,000 followers. I'm almost at 13,000. So follow me on Twitter, get me over that. And then you can go to AaronMcCready.com. I've got a site there. You can listen to all previous episodes, and there's some news feeds going on there also. And go to Blog Talk Radio tomorrow. This episode is a staff pick and will be featured on Blog Talk Radio's homepage out of thousands of episodes of shows every single day. Again, thanks for tuning in. It's been a great honor and privilege. do have a show Thursday night at 8 o'clock. Come back and see us. Thank you so much.